It is Monday, November 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the United States reimposes sanctions on Iran's oil and financial sectors.
Treasury Secretary Mnuchin made clear just the scope of these sanctions, saying that Monday, 700 individuals, entities, aircrafts, and vessels were targeted.
Voters in the U.S. prepare to go to the polls for the midterm elections, and memories of World War I provoke some mixed reactions. It's all ahead. The Trump administration reimposed sanctions on Iran's oil industry and financial sector, following through on pledges to roll back relief Iran has received as part of the international agreement to limit its nuclear program. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said Monday the sanctions restore bans on purchasing Iranian oil, a major component of Iran's economy. VOA State Department correspondent Cindy Sain tells me U.S. officials believe it is now up to Iran to determine its future.
Secretary Pompeo said that the Iranian regime, as he said, can either do a 180-degree turn from what he called its outlaw course of action and act like a normal country, or it can see its economy crumble. And Treasury Secretary Mnuchin made clear just the scope of these sanctions, saying that Monday, 700 individuals, entities, aircrafts, and vessels were targeted in the U.S. Treasury's largest ever single-day action. So this was a very, very comprehensive move today.
However, there are countries that are receiving waivers, including Turkey, China, India, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Italy, and Greece. Apparently, they represent the majority of Iran's oil exports. So in a way, these sanctions seem like they're somewhat restrained.
That's right, Sarah. And some critics are saying, you know, that the administration has not been tough enough in allowing the sanctions. And as the secretary announced, those countries, who are basically some of Iran's biggest importers of Iranian oil, he said, indicated that the U.S. also did not want to destabilize the international oil market. So that may have been a consideration. You know, there's always political considerations, domestic political considerations with these measures as well. And I think the U.S. does not want to see, you know, domestic gasoline prices skyrocketing.
Particularly with the midterms coming up.
Yes, right.
What has been the Iranian reaction to this?
Well, so far, Iranian leaders have been defiant, saying that they will continue to sell oil and that they will be proud to defy these sanctions, and saying that it is the U.S., which is, in fact, isolated in the international community. So we'll have to see. You know, there's been some interesting indications on both sides saying, well, you know, we would like to talk. Secretary Pompeo has said that the president would be willing to talk, but Iran would need to ask. And so we'll see whether these sanctions will perhaps lead to some kind of new talks and some kind of new deal with Iran in the future.
Iran has denied that its nuclear program is designed at producing nuclear weapons, saying it isn't complying with the 2015 agreement. So I guess there's a lot of dispute as to whether Iran is in compliance or not.
Well, that's right. And some, even a lot of experts here in the U.S. have said that Iran was, in fact, in compliance with the Iran, the so-called Iran nuclear deal. And President Trump pulling out of the deal in May, this administration, the Trump administration, has always stressed that Iran is a bad actor, they say, in a lot of other ways. And they were asked, Secretary Pompeo was asked, you know, why are you sanctioning Iran and not Saudi Arabia? You know, we've just seen recently the brutal murder of a journalist in a Saudi consulate in Turkey. And Secretary Pompeo said that there's a remarkable difference between the two, and that Saudi Arabia has helped the U.S. in counterterrorism efforts, whereas he said that Iran is the single most destabilizing factor in the Middle East today.
VOA State Department correspondent Cindy Sain. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Turkey accuses the Saudis of trying to cover up the killing of a journalist. The U.S. Supreme Court leaves unenforced net neutrality rules on the books. China and Pakistan agree to conduct bilateral trade in the Chinese yuan. And 78 students and a principal are kidnapped in Cameroon. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA has concluded that the 11-year mission of the Dawn spacecraft and its exploration of Vesta and Ceres, two of the largest objects in the asteroid belt, has come to an end. According to the space agency, the spacecraft missed scheduled communication sessions with NASA's Deep Space Network not only on October 31st, but also on November 1st. NASA says the Dawn flight team checked through a number of possible causes for that lack of contact, but the mission's managers realized that the spacecraft simply ran out of its hydrazine fuel. That fuel supply allowed mission specialists to control the spacecraft's pointing. Without this ability, Dawn was no longer able to set its antennas to communicate with its controllers on Earth, nor could it turn and adjust its solar panels to get a power recharge from the sun. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, World War I altered the destinies of many people and nations in the Middle East, and we'll have a report about it. U.S. voters choose a new Congress Tuesday in a midterm election that could have a significant impact on the balance of power in Washington and on the next 2 years of Donald Trump's presidency. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has a preview.
At stake on Tuesday are all 435 seats in the House of Representatives, 35 of the 100 U.S. Senate seats, and 36 state governors' races. In the final days of the campaign, President Donald Trump is trying to boost Republican turnout with a focus on immigration.
Republicans want strong borders, no crime, no chaos, and no caravans. Democrats want open borders, and they want to invite caravan after caravan into our country, which brings crime upon crime.
Democrats are focused on health care and Trump's governing style and are counting on a strong voter turnout with help from top Democrats like former President Barack Obama.
You can choose a bigger, more hopeful, more generous vision of America. But to do it, you got to vote.
Democrats expect to make gains on Tuesday, according to Brookings Institution analyst John Hudak.
Right now, it does look like Democrats will do quite well in House races, probably enough to take back majority control of the House. And the Senate will remain quite divided, likely in Republican hands.
And President Trump figures to be a top issue for voters in both parties, says American University expert Alan Lichtman.
I think this is the most nationalized election in modern memory. It was a recent poll which said that two-thirds of Americans believe that Donald Trump will be a major or a minor factor in their voting. Two-thirds.
Trump is also running against history, says analyst Kyle Kondik.
Again, the midterm history is pretty stark in that the president's party usually loses ground in the midterm. It's just a question of how much ground they lose. That's particularly true when a president is unpopular, as this president is.
If Democrats are able to win back control of the House, it could alter the next 2 years of the Trump presidency. John Fortier is with the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington.
It looks a lot different if there's divided government and Democrats have part of the levers of power. They won't be there to pass Trump legislation, but more importantly, they'll be there to really raise a louder voice against Donald Trump through investigations and their opportunity to really put another viewpoint forward.
Republicans remain slight favorites to maintain their narrow 51 to 49 seat edge in the U.S. Senate. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
The husband of the Pakistani woman freed after 8 years awaiting execution for blasphemy has appealed to the U.S., Britain, and Canada for refuge for his family. Ashiq Masih has pleaded for help, saying they're in trouble and living under an increased sense of fear. Their lawyer has already fled. Asia Bibi had been jailed awaiting death by hanging since 2010, when she was cleared by members of the Pakistani Supreme Court last week. She has steadfastly denied having insulted Islam's prophet. Her acquittal sparked days of protests, with cars torched, public buildings attacked, and roads blocked. Dozens were arrested. Protesters demanded the government prevent her from leaving the country, pending an appeal of the court decision. Moeen Chima is an associate law lecturer at the Australian National University. He was asked by International Edition's Victor Beattie whether the family will gain refuge outside of Pakistan.
I think in many of these instances, quite understandably, refuge is sought, and a number of jurisdictions have been, especially Europe and occasionally the United States, has been quite helpful in terms of providing such people asylum, which they necessarily deserve.
Are you surprised at the fairly violent protests that erupted following the acquittal?
Not at all, actually. This case has been going on and has been highly politicized for the last 7 or 8 years. If people might recall that it was in the context of this particular case that a governor in Pakistan was shot by his own security guard for pleading for Asia Bibi's case and for calling for a change in Pakistan's blasphemy laws. Pakistan's minority religious minister was also subsequently shot to death for making a protest against the blasphemy laws and particularly, the misuse in Asia Bibi's case. So there are often widespread protests among certain segments of the religious right when issues of blasphemy come up. And this case has been in particular a lightning rod for such sentiment and for such violent protests.
Kadeem Hussein Rizvi, who heads the Tariq-e-Labaik party, said there will be war if authorities allow Asia and her family out of the country. Do you agree with that assessment?
This is a new political party on the religious right, which has won a few votes in the most recent elections. They've been quite vocal on the issue of blasphemy laws and have protested against the previous government before the elections as well. This is a highly politicized issue for them, and that has been essentially their main manifesto point in the run-up to the elections and even in the aftermath of the elections. So they will obviously protest and try to arm twist the state as much as they possibly can. Up till this point, they've gotten away with it. At every such juncture, the government and even the military has negotiated with them rather than cracking down on such protests, which often get violent and lead to destruction of public and private property. But this situation is untenable. This is a Supreme Court verdict. If the Supreme Court releases Asia Bibi, the government has no justification whatsoever for detaining her or even forcing her to stay within the country. And so when eventually she will be released, this will lead to another confrontation, and there will be a decision to be made by the government whether it is going to tolerate such protests indefinitely, or is it actually going to finally crack down and sort this issue out once and for all.
Moeen Chima of the Australian National University. As the world marks the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I in 1918, some in the Middle East mourn the fate of nations and peoples who came out losers in the ultimate dissection of the region and the division of the Ottoman Empire. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Armenians mourn their dead during a World War I genocide in which close to 1.5 million people were killed. Other peoples who suffered from that war, including Greeks, Assyrians, and Kurds, recall its memory with bitterness. As the war ended, the Ottoman Empire was divided, leaving communities shattered and broken by ethnic cleansing. University of Oklahoma Middle East Program Director Joshua Landis says the Ottoman Empire had allowed many ethnic communities to govern themselves.
The Ottoman Empire was a Sunni dynastic empire, and it was a multi-religious, multi-ethnic empire.
the various religious and ethnic communities were not equal, but there was a stability, and they got along within a framework of Ottoman authority. Once that was destroyed, and the French and British imposed national identities and chopped the place up to nation states, many of these nation states included peoples who did not want to live together, and this has led to the recent civil wars.
Minorities like Armenians and Kurds, who were not awarded nation states, paid a heavy price, as Haigazian University President Paul Haydostyan tells VOA.
World War I really changed the demographic picture so quickly. So 20 years after World War I, if you looked at the demography of many of the regions in Asia Minor and Middle East and so on, they had been impacted, moved, deported, and changed in dramatic ways. And there was no protection, and there was no logic to what happened except for the consequences of alliances, of wars, and so on.
But some minorities, like Lebanon's Maronite Christians or Syria's Alawites, gained prominence in the period after World War I during the destruction of the old world order, says Landis.
The French and the British pursued a minority policy, and in order to help them rule during the interwar period, they gave a leg up to minorities throughout the Middle East. In Lebanon, of course, it's the Maronites. In Syria, it was the Alawites. In Iraq, it was the Sunni minority, 20%. In Israel, Palestine, it was the Jews, who were only 14% of the population at World War I.
Haydostyan says despite the war's aftermath, Armenians, Kurds, Jews, and other minorities rebuilt their communities and struggled once again to flourish.
So many nations, despite the major losses of land, home, human lives, in the hundreds of thousands, in the case of the Armenian, 1.5 million, the story of resilience is really very particular. No matter what some nations may do, minorities, ethnic or religious groups find a way of surviving.
A key lesson of World War I, concludes Paul Haydostyan, is the intersection of the interests of the major powers, the mightier powers, versus those of the smaller powers, which he argues ultimately pay the price. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
And we'll have more on the World War I centenary coming up. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. In Europe, ceremonies will take place to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. Nearly 37 million soldiers and civilians perished in the huge war, which took place from 1914 until 1918. It was triggered by the assassination of the heir presumptive to the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Grand Duke Franz Ferdinand, in Sarajevo. This theme, The Last Post, will be featured at British and Commonwealth ceremonies. Reporter Jamie Detmer in London tells me reactions are mixed to the remembrance.
Well, I mean, I think there's ambiguity. It has always been a war, really, even in the war years itself, particularly after the war, where remembrance has been a difficult thing in terms of getting the balance, I suppose, for many people, of how do you mark and show respect to the dead, to the fallen. 10 million soldiers died in the war without, in a way, celebrating some kind of, if you were a victor, a military triumph, because most people, I think, particularly as the years drew on after the war, didn't really feel like celebrating. It was the first industrial age, really, war, where science and technology was used and the casualties were on a massive scale. There's hardly a household in Britain or Western Europe that wasn't touched by the war. And now the memories, of course, are held in photographs and letters and in the war poems of the war poets, several of whom were very critical of the war, like Wilfred Owen. So I think there's always a feeling of ambiguity about the First World War.
There was a decision made by officials from some countries, including Britain, when men were killed, they were buried on the field of battle. They were not brought home. And yet that was controversial as well.
Yes, it was. And it's something that hasn't really been covered. It's been, you know, very much until recently uncovered, I may say recently. The British were the first who came up with this idea that they wanted an equality of remembrance. So that for the first time ever, it was a revolutionary idea, for the first time ever, soldiers would be buried in war cemeteries on the battlefields where they fell, officers alongside ordinary soldiers. And that was meant to be a mark of respect. But many women, many widows, who were inconsolable, really, in their grief, started a writing campaign and wanting their husbands' bodies returned so they could be in the local cemeteries near them at home. The British wouldn't concede to that. The French did. Several countries followed Britain with this idea of equality of remembrance, but the French did turn over 300,000 bodies back to their families, and the Americans offered any American family who was bereaved, who wanted the body of their dead back, they would ship them at the United States government's cost.
Yeah, well, of course, in the American case, they were so far away.
Yes, and the numbers weren't as high, of course. America came into this war quite late, but 116,000, 117,000 war dead for the Americans, which is, you know, a fraction compared to what Britain, France, Germany, and Belgium, and, of course, the Russians suffered.
Yes, well, in France, the site of so many of these battles, French President Emmanuel Macron, he's being very careful about this. He doesn't want to show any triumphalism in these ceremonies.
Yes, he's had some criticism from some military veterans who feel that this is insulting the soldiers of the Great War, as it's called. But many veterans are supportive of this. A retired British general, Richard Dannett, said, you know, triumphalism, I'm quoting him now, triumphalism, victory, those are sorts of notions that are inappropriate. There is no need for jingoistic reaction at all, he said. I think a lot of young people think the focus should be on peace. A lot of older people think it should be on the idea of reconciliation. There's a feeling that we, you know, now we're all allies. You don't want to humiliate the countries who were vanquished in this. And it's also a point that Theresa May has picked up. I mean, she has said that the killing fields of France and Belgium show really now how important the closeness of relationship is between European countries who had been at war previously.
How is the First World War being remembered in Britain, where you are?
Well, it's quite extraordinary. The BBC, in particular, has virtually two or three documentaries a day running this week, and they had last week as well. There are events up and down the country, small and large. There's going to be a huge ceremony on Armistice Day on November the 11th at Westminster Abbey. 10,000 lights have been set ablaze around the Tower of London to illuminate the tower and the moat. They've got to be replenished every 4 hours. They'll be relit in the evenings, every evening this week. Interestingly, in the villages around London, so I haven't been further north recently, but I think it's north as well, across the country, many villages have got small events, and they've got silhouettes of First World War Tommies, soldiers, in the village roads, in and out of the roads. They've got poppies. I mean, it is something that has touched a chord here, surprisingly, I mean, very deeply. But, I mean, the feeling that I get, and it's also the tone of many of these documentaries on the BBC and in my conversations with ordinary people, is a sense of tremendous sadness that so many young men died. And it really is a sense of trying to respect their memory, their sacrifice. And I've not really sensed anyone wanting to be triumphant about this war.
Jamie Dettner reporting from London. And that is our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.